And tonight I'm so happy to introduce Andrew Solomon, the National Book Award winner for The Noonday Demon. And his monumental new work, Far From the Tree, which tells the story of parents who learn to deal with their exceptional children, but also find profound meaning while doing so. He explores deafness, Down syndrome, autism, and other states, and discusses a crucial question: to what extent should a parent accept their children for what they are, and to what extent should they help them become their better selves, and what, in fact, are their better selves? And this incredible book explores themes of generosity and acceptance and made me examine my own beliefs in so many areas. A truly amazing work which expands our definition of what it is to be human. When I met Andrew years ago, I read A Galley for his novel, A Stone Boat, which dazzled me. And I organized a reading at Books and Company so my customers could be introduced to this brilliant young writer. He is also the author of The Ivory Tower, Soviet Artists in a Time of Glasnost, as well as The Noonday Demon, an Atlas of Depression, winner of 14 national awards and published in 22 languages. And I was so happy speaking to Andrew tonight. He was saying he grew up in this library, and so he's very familiar, and we're glad to welcome him back. Let us welcome Andrew Solomon.
Well, thank you all. Thank you all for venturing out on this January night to join me. It's true, I grew up about seven blocks from here, and I spent much of my childhood and adolescence coming in here to work on various kinds of school papers and to read books in the children's room, and I have endless fond associations with it. And it is true that Jeanette had me to Books and Company, which aside from the New York Society Library was the center of literacy for everyone in New York in its day, and which is terribly missed. So I'm going to talk a bit about the book that I've written, and when I finish, I'm going to show a short video that I have of some of the people who are in the book, just a few minutes long, a book trailer, as they are now called, and I will then take some questions and try to give you some answers to them. So I'll begin by describing how I started on this book. Almost 20 years ago, my editors at the Times Magazine gave me an assignment to write an article about the deaf. And I was very mystified by the assignment when I got it. I had mostly been doing foreign reporting, and one of my editors said, but this seems like a foreign culture that's within our own boundaries. And so I went off to meet deaf people, and I had had the idea, which is commonplace and was even more commonplace then, that deafness was nothing but a nuisance and a disadvantage and a problem, and these poor people couldn't hear, and wasn't that awful for them, and what could be done to help them. And then I went out into the deaf world, and I began meeting deaf people. I began going to deaf clubs. I began understanding how an alarm clock that worked with lights went. I went to the Miss Deaf America competition, which was an experience for a whole variety of reasons. And as I did all of this, I really came to understand that deafness, while it is a disability, is also a culture, and that people who are deaf are linked by their common experience of using sign language as their primary means of communication. And what I also discovered is that most deaf people are born to hearing parents. And those hearing parents tend to think the best thing for their children would be to function in the hearing world. And so they emphasize lip reading, and they emphasize oral speech, the production of oral speech. And the children go on and on trying to learn these things so they can fit into their parents' world. And many of them in their early teens, or some of them not until their 20s or 30s, discover the deaf culture. And when they discover it, it comes as a revelation to them. And they realize that while they may have learned to function to some degree in their parents' world, that this really is the world that's real and true to them. And I was very interested in that experience because it closely paralleled my experience as a gay person of being born into a family in which my condition was incomprehensible to my family at some level, and they weren't so enthusiastic about it. And it really was a matter of trying to understand what the dynamics were. And over time, I came to think that the dynamics of discovering your deafness and the experience of discovering your gayness were really very parallel experiences. And then I had a friend of a friend who had a daughter who was a dwarf. And she started saying, well, I just haven't decided whether I should bring her up to know a lot of other dwarfs and join the little people of America, or to tell her she's exactly like anyone else. She's just a little bit short. And as she talked about this whole question and the set of questions, I thought, here it is again. And I thought, okay, if it's occurred in these three instances, it must surely be occurring in other instances as well. And that was the moment when the idea for the book was born. It was after that conversation about dwarfism. And I thought, what are all of the other categories? Now, in writing about the deaf, I happened to be writing about the deaf just at the point when the cochlear implant, a technology that allows a sort of synthetic equivalent of hearing, was coming into a much wider circulation and was beginning to work better than it previously had. And so we had this sort of strange thing in which the culture, the larger culture, was more and more accepting of the idea of deaf culture, hence my getting this assignment in the first place and the responses that I got to it. The acceptance of deaf culture coexisted with a moment when, for functional purposes, many people who would previously have been deaf were not going to be deaf anymore. And I've said in the book that it's a little like the end of those operas in which the hero realizes he loves the heroine at the exact moment that she expires on a divan center stage. And I wanted to look at that tension between a medical model that was about curing something and a cultural model that was about accepting or even celebrating it, and to see how they played off against each other in a variety of contexts. And I also wanted to look at the idea that deafness, I thought it was an illness. I had then become persuaded it was an identity. It was then being treated medically as an illness. And it's not that when I thought that it was an identity, I decided it wasn't a disability and that it would be great if everyone were deaf. I merely decided that there were people for whom that was true. And I thought, well, when I was growing up, gayness was an illness. And in my adult life, it's an identity. And the adult life I have was unimaginable when I was growing up. And I thought if gayness could shift from the illness model to the identity model before anyone came up with a cure for it, then what are the other things that could make that transfer and that could move from one thing to the other? I found that sometimes when I talk to people about this, they don't realize how serious the anti-gay bias really was. People have tended to forget it. This is from a magazine that was published when I was about 2 years old, Time Magazine, Voice of the American Mainstream. Even in purely non-religious terms, homosexuality represents a misuse of the sexual faculty. It is a pathetic little second-rate substitute for reality, a pitiable flight from life. It deserves no encouragement, no glamorization, no rationalization, no fake status as minority martyrdom, no sophistry about simple differences in taste, and above all, no pretense that it is anything but a pernicious sickness. So we've got from that to having a president who has come out in favor of gay marriage represents an extraordinary cultural shift. And I was very interested in seeing where else such a cultural shift might perhaps be realized. And I had a lot of very intense and very engaging experiences, and I talked to a lot of activists in one field and another. And I found that many of them were very, very angry about the way their conditions had been treated. So one of my chapters is about autism. I divided the book. The first half are things that have been perceived as illnesses, and the second half, things that have at some level been perceived as identities or might be processed as identities. So the first half includes chapters on deafness, dwarfism, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, and multiple severe disabilities. And the second half on prodigies, because genius too is an abnormality and can be very challenging to the families of people who are either blessed or afflicted with it, depending how one wants to look at it. I did a chapter on families bringing up children conceived in rape, because I wanted to look at the idea that having a child who presents a challenge to love can lie not only in who that the child's DNA or chromosomes or a health condition, but also can lie in the point that the child came from, that too can pose many of these challenges. a chapter on families of people who commit crimes, to look at the way that what a child does can actually catapult that child into such a category, and a chapter on people who are transgender. And I framed it with a little bit of my own experience. Among the autism activists, many of whom I went and met, there also was this very energetic rejection of medical models and a lot of anger about the search for a cure. And initially I thought, but autism. Autism is not so easy. I came to think in the first place that the autism that involves a child with no language banging his head against the corner and the autism that involves a tenure-track position at MIT, though they lie on a continuum, are in many ways very different experiences, and obviously the activists are people who have access to language. But I also thought that the idea of autism as an identity for those people in many instances seemed to me no more far-fetched than the idea of deafness as an identity or of gayness as an identity. And having been somewhat traumatized by efforts made, both by myself and others, to resolve my gayness, I was somewhat sympathetic to the anger that they felt about people trying to resolve their autism. This is what one of the activists said. When parents say, "I wish my child did not have autism," what they're really saying is, "I wish the autistic child I have did not exist, and I had a different, non-autistic child instead." Read that again. This is what we hear when you mourn over our existence. This is what we hear when you pray for a cure. This is what we know when you tell us of your fondest hopes and dreams for us, that your greatest wish is that one day we will cease to be, and strangers you can love will move in behind our faces. I'll go now to some of these categories. In each category, I interviewed large numbers of families and tried to look at the family dynamics that surrounded the conditions and the situations and so on and so forth. And it was a very intense process. I interviewed about 300 families altogether in working on the book. Quite a lot of them made their way into it in some way. There was a deaf man who I got to be quite close to and who helped me a bit with research on the book, and we had a frequent email correspondence. He didn't have spoken language, so when we met, we either typed back and forth or had a translator, which is expensive and which we therefore didn't do so much. But at one point, I was asking him what he thought about the cochlear implant question, and he said, "While I'm pretty comfortable with my disability and don't see CI as an evil force intent on destroying the deaf culture, I do get a sense of impending extinction. There will always be deaf people worldwide, but there is a real possibility that it'll be near eradicated in developed countries within 50 to 100 years. I say near because there will always be immigrants, untreatable conditions, cultural holdouts, and so on. But no more people like me." And part of what the book examines is that question of what does it mean to think there will be no more people like me? What does it mean for the individuals, and what does it mean for the larger society? What happens when we begin eliminating various kinds of diversity and various experiences that are outside of the mainstream? And a lot of the families I met talked about how they were incredibly upset when they got the diagnosis, whatever it was, for their child. And then they had come to love this child very much. And many of them ended up saying, "I feel like in a way it's given me an even more glorious experience of parenthood than I would have had otherwise." And I would question them about that, and I would question the sensibility. There's a dwarf who you'll see in the film at the end named Clinton Brown. And when he was born, the doctors said to his mother that he had diastrophic dwarfism, that it was an incredibly disabling condition, that he wouldn't live for very long, that he would not have any ability to interact with other people, and that they should just leave him at the hospital to be taken care of until he died. And his mother, who was a telephone operator, and his father, who was a construction worker, neither of them with advanced education, decided they would take him home. And in that pre-internet moment in the mid-80s when he was born, they figured out who the best doctor was for treating diastrophic dwarfism, who was a doctor at Johns Hopkins. They brought him in for a number of surgeries, in fact, 30 of them before the time that he turned 12, to try to straighten out his legs and so on, which were very bent and twisted and deformed. And through the process of doing all of that, they were able, he now can walk. He did develop not only language, but became a very articulate fellow. It was an extraordinary transformation that they were able to achieve. And he was in the hospital. He had nothing else to do while he was there, so he read a lot of school books because there wasn't much else to do, and ended up being the first person in his family to go to college. And I will always remember talking to his mother one night, and he went to college. They live on Long Island, and he went to Adelphi, which is not far from where his parents live. And I will always remember calling his mother and having her say to me, "Ah," she said, "so today I was out driving, and I was driving down the expressway, and I saw this bar." She said, "Clinton now has this car with all these fittings. It's very easy to recognize," she said. "And there he was. There was the car, and it was parked outside a bar," she said. And I thought to myself, "They're 6 feet tall. He's 3 feet tall. Two beers for them is four beers for him." I thought, "I can't go in there." But I went home, and I left about 8 messages on his cell phone. And then I thought, if someone had told me when he was born that my worry would be that he would go out drinking and driving with his college buddies, I would have been so thrilled to have that problem. And this is part of what she has said to me later on when I said to her, I said, "But okay, he's achieved. I mean, he has achieved more than anyone in his family has, despite these extraordinary disabilities and the tightness of that bond. I've never seen a closer family." And it has, in a way, been a rich experience for them. And I said to his mother, What did you do to let him emerge into this sort of extraordinary person?" And she said, "I don't think we did anything to make him into him. What did I do? I loved him. That's all. The other day, these people, much higher up than us socially, much more educated, called me up and said they couldn't handle this. They were in Texas politics and thought the stigma would be harmful to them. And they gave their baby up for adoption. That's just what they were going to do. And it's the opposite of what I was going to do, right from the beginning. The other day, Clinton came home and he goes, 'Ma, I saw a blind man today with a stick in Manhattan. There were people rushing back and forth, and he was all alone. I just felt like crying. I felt so sorry for him. So I offered to bring him to where he needed to go.' Clinton just always had that light in him. And we were lucky enough to be the first to see it there." And so I found that there often was this process through which parents became deeply, profoundly attached to children who were not what they would have expected. And there, too, in the experience of those parents, there was a certain radicalism. This will be the last of my readings from a magazine from the 1960s, but this is from 1968, an ethicist writing in the Atlantic Monthly, which, again, was not, you know, known for its extremist views. Joseph Fletcher wrote, "There is no reason to feel guilty about putting a Down syndrome baby away, whether it's put away in the sense of hidden in a sanatorium or in a more responsible, lethal sense. It is sad, yes, dreadful, but it carries no guilt. True guilt arises only from an offense against a person, and a Downs is not a person." We forget how much change there's been. We forget how much transformation there is. And as I worked on the chapter about families of children with Down syndrome, I had many very moving encounters with people. Down syndrome is an area in which, because of advances in educational techniques, people are arriving at cognitive achievements that were previously unimaginable. And because of improvements in medical treatment of certain aspects of the condition, people with Down syndrome are living 3 or 4 times as long as they used to live. And life for people with Down syndrome is radically changed at the same time that the increasing available of prenatal screening is causing more and more people to choose not to go forward having children like this. I don't take a moral position about it. I don't think anyone should be obliged to have a child they don't want under any circumstances ever. But I do think that a lot of the time those decisions are made without a great deal of knowledge. And I was very moved by the story of Tom and Karen Robards, who live on the west side here, just across the park. And when I met them, their son was 23 years old, and they had been working for a long time in the area of Down syndrome education. It set up a center called the Cook Center, which was a place where a lot of people with Down syndrome were getting this better education, had ultimately, I mean, they started it as a tiny, tiny little thing and it sort of took off, had ultimately devoted a lot of energy to it and come up with many of the techniques that help people with Down syndrome. And I said, well, look, this has been such a huge part of your life. Do you wish it hadn't been? Do you wish your son didn't have Down syndrome? Do you wish you could make it go away? And his mother said, you know, for David, our son, I wish I could make it go away, because for David, it's a difficult way to be in the world. She said, but I think that we've grown so much as a result of having to deal with this. We've had so much purpose. I'd never have believed 23 years ago when he was born that I could come to such a point, but I have. For David, I'd cure it in an instant, but for us, I wouldn't exchange these experiences for anything. They've made us who we are, and who we are is so much better than who we would have been otherwise. And I kept encountering that theme of families who loved their children, children they had thought it would be impossible to love, who found that there was a lot of meaning in the experience of bringing those children up. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit to talk about people with many severe disabilities, and just to quote again one mother, fathers often had a lot to say, but mothers often said it in the most condensed and pungent form. And this was a mother who had two children. She had a child born with extreme disabilities, no control over movement, no ability to feed himself, no ability to walk or to communicate, was told that it was a randomly occurring genetic mutation and that she was not at risk of producing another such child, and had another child who had the same condition and had to deal with that. And eventually she took care of the children until they became too heavy and difficult to move around, and eventually felt that they had to go into some kind of an assisted housing situation. They went into one, and a few years later, there was a worker who left one of them in the bathtub while she went to get something, and he drowned. And she and I talked about what that whole experience had been like, and I will just quote to you one of the things she said at his funeral. She said, as she was burying his ashes, "Let me bury here the rage I feel to have been twice robbed, once of the child I wanted, and once of the son I loved." That's the point that many people came to. Now, I don't by any means wish to say that actually having these children is something that automatically confers that feeling. And another family with two severely disabled children, the mother said, "People always regale us with these little sayings, like, 'God doesn't give you any more than you can handle.' But children like ours are not preordained as a gift. They're a gift because that's what we have chosen." And I returned over and over again to that line and to that idea that many of these families, many of them, had really struggled to try to find meaning in their experience. And there was a point at which I thought, okay, you say that you would never have wanted to have any other child than the one you had, but is that really true? Is it really true that you wouldn't have preferred a child who didn't have these problems and didn't have these disadvantages and wasn't facing so much difficulty? I thought about it, and I thought about the fact that I have children, and my children are flawed in minor ways, and that if some glorious angel broke through my living room ceiling and offered to exchange them for other, better children who were nicer and more attractive and better behaved and so on and so forth, I would be horrified by that offer, and I would hold on to the children I have. One becomes attached to one's own life experience and to one's sense of one's own destiny. And I found that for many of these parents, it wasn't a question of whether it was true that they were better off having a child with autism or Down syndrome. If they could believe that this had given them some meaning, if they could say, look at the things that I learned from this that I would never have learned otherwise, if they could find words of praise for their own experience, that liberated them to be much better parents to the children, and it was an enormously helpful thing for them in finding a reasonable degree of meaning in their own life. So that was a real focus for me, was the idea that you construct these realities. Now, I mentioned that I included a chapter on prodigies, and I did, and a lot of the prodigies wondered what they were doing in a book with people with schizophrenia and so on. And I said that it's actually difference which is difficult, and difference which requires an enormous adjustment. Whether it's positive or negative difference has an effect on how sad it is. It is not as sad to have a child who is a prodigy as it is to have a child who is multiply disabled. But it is probably equally difficult insofar as the difficulty doesn't inhere in sadness. And I found that the parents I talked to were constantly struggling, that it's as difficult to have the mind of a 30-year-old in the body of a 5-year-old as it is to have the mind of a 5-year-old in the body of a 30-year-old. And that these parents were constantly trying to find peers for these children who had no peers. The people who were there in the areas of interest mostly didn't want to spend time with the little kid, and the other little kids didn't understand what they were talking about. And I had an experience partway through. I interviewed a young man who was 7 and his mother, and I knew that he had a very rigorous practice schedule. He was taking lessons. He was flying back and forth to China for lessons, as well as studying with a piano teacher in California. And I said to his mother, "Do you ever worry about his having a normal childhood?" And Mark, this little boy, Mark Yu, said to me, "Actually, I have quite a normal childhood. Do you want to come upstairs and see my room? It's messy, but you can come anyway." And so we went upstairs, and he showed me his favorite cartoons, and I took note of the fact that he had a whole shelf of Sesame Street videos. And then after we'd been up there for a few minutes, he said, "Okay," he said, "let's go downstairs, and I'll play you the Chopin Fantasy Impromptu." And so we went down the stairs, and he sat down, and he played with adult yearning and with a fluidity and intelligence that are almost beyond description, the beauty of it, this version of the Chopin Fantasy Impromptu. And I thought, how on earth can someone who watches Cookie Monster also be able to do this? And when he finished playing, he put his hands in his lap, and his mother turned to me and said, "You see, he's not a normal child. Why should he have a normal childhood?" And she expanded on that by saying this. She said, she's from Macau. She said, "In America, every kid has to be well-rounded. Americans want everyone to have the same life. It's a cult of the average. This is wonderful for disabled children who get things they would never have otherwise, but it's a disaster for gifted children. Why should Mark spend his life learning sports he's not interested in when he has this superb gift that gives him so much joy?" And I have to say, he's now older, and he does not regret his childhood. He's about 12 now, and I saw him when I was in California on book tour, and he seems quite content. I'm going to skip over a few more chapters and close with two stories, one of them about the family of someone who had committed a crime, and one of them about the family of someone who is transgender. So the criminal I'm going to talk about is Dylan Klebold, who is one of the perpetrators of the Columbine Massacre. And I interviewed his family, who had not previously spoken on the record to anyone, and spent an enormous amount of time with them out in Colorado. And there are a couple of moments of incredible clarity for me. We used to think that gayness was caused by overbearing mothers and passive fathers. And we used to think that autism was caused by so-called refrigerator mothers. And we used to think that schizophrenia came of the parents' unconscious wish that their child not exist. And if we go back a couple of hundred years, people used to think that children who had dwarfism or deformity were expressing the unrealized erotic longings of their mothers. And so this idea that it all came from the mother persisted in all of these arenas, and in all of these arenas we've dropped that idea, though its legacy lives on in the experience of such mothers. But in the area of crime, everyone still thinks that the crime was caused by the parents, that the parents should somehow have known and stopped it, and that in our household, these things don't happen. It's a line that I effectively heard over and over again. I had an interviewer this morning from Nova, who's doing some project on mass killings spurred by the Newtown Massacre, and who kept asking me the same question over and over again until I finally had to ask him to stop. And he kept saying, "But don't you really think that Dylan Klebold's parents..." And I said, "No, if I really thought that, that's what I would have written." I think Dylan Klebold was very secretive, and I loved his parents, which I did not expect to do. I love them. I would have been happy to have them as my own parents. They're kind and good and moral people. At the end of the first weekend I spent interviewing them, I said, Well, if Dylan were here now, I said, is there anything you'd want to ask him? We were sitting at the kitchen table. We were all very tired. It had been a very intense weekend of interviews. And his father said, there sure is. I'd want to ask him what the hell he thought he was doing. And his mother looked at the floor, and she thought for a minute, and then she looked up and said, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head. A few years later, she and I were having dinner in Denver, and she said this, when it first happened, I used to wish that I had never had children, that I had never married. If Tom and I hadn't crossed paths at Ohio State, Dylan wouldn't have existed, and this terrible thing wouldn't have happened. But over time, I've come to feel that for myself, I am glad I had kids, and glad I had the kids I did, because the love for them, even at the price of this pain, has been the single greatest joy of my life. When I say that, I am speaking of my own pain and not of the pain of other people. But I accept my own pain. Life is full of suffering, and this is mine. I know it would have been better for the world if Dylan had never been born, but I believe it would not have been better for me. Transgender presented its own set of challenges. Transgender people experience a level of prejudice and abuse that's almost unimaginable until one has been in the world of them. They're frequently taken away from the families that they belong to. I spent a lot of time with one couple who lost their child for 2 years because the school said that they were causing him to behave in this way. There is a great deal of cruelty that comes up around people who are transgender, and many of the stories were really sickening and horrifying. Ku Klux Klan coming and marching into people's houses, and I mean, really terrible, terrible thing. People having to go into hiding because there were people threatening to kill 8-year-old children on grounds that they were somehow not conforming to gender norms. And when I started writing about people who are transgender, I thought it was an interesting topic to which I had no more real connection than I did to deafness or dwarfism or autism. And then as I worked on it, I thought, gee, I was bullied quite a lot as a child. Not here at the library, but elsewhere where I had to go. And I thought a lot of it really had to do not with my being gay, because I hadn't conceived of sexuality yet, but with the ways in which I deviated from gender norms. So Kim Reed was, in an earlier incarnation, the quarterback on her high school football team, and she ended up going back to Montana for her 20th high school reunion and making a film which was about what that whole experience was like. And my favorite moment in the film actually is when she's sitting on a sofa with several people and they're all drinking beer, and one of her classmates come over and says, but Kim, we've all changed. But she made the film, and then she got a call from the pastor at her church who said that he would like to have a weekend in which the film was shown on Friday, in which on Saturday there were seminars to discuss the issues that were brought up in it, and on Sunday she would be invited to preach the sermon at her church, which indeed she did. And I'm just going to read you a little extract from that sermon, which she wrote the night before delivering it. She said, the night before last, when our film was playing in here, I went outside to the columbarium where my father's ashes rest. As I was kneeling there by what I called Dad's spot, I thought of the hours and hours of videotape that he shot lovingly of me during my football games, and how much of the same footage was now being shown inside this sanctuary. Now, it's certainly not the context that any of us expected, but I knew Dad would be proud. And just then, the dusk breeze blew in this waft of sound, and it was strangely familiar to me, and I realized it was the crosstown football game coming from the stadium. The band was playing, and the announcer was bellowing, and all of these old tapes were playing inside here on the screen, and I knew that new ones were being recorded just a few blocks away. Those recording their new memories to tape should be only so lucky as to be surprised by the last thing that they expected from their loved ones, only so fortunate as to get a chance to welcome them home with radical love. I thought about how all these cycles of lives would continue on, and so many aspects of my life coalesced in that one moment, that one beautiful, stunning, blessed moment, the past and the present, parent and child, male and female, the pain that life sometimes brings, and the soothing love that welcomes it with open arms after its exhausting journey into a distant country. You'll see her in a moment in the film. I closed the book with the story of having a family myself, with my husband, who's sweetly here being supportive tonight. He is the father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minneapolis, to whom we're very close. I have a daughter with a college friend in Texas, she's the sparkle of my eye. And then we have a son who lives with us all the time, who's the youngest one. And the day that our son was born, we were told that the day after, actually, the pediatrician came in and said he wasn't extending his legs correctly and suggested that he might have brain damage, and we spent the first day of his life getting an MRI. It turned out he didn't have brain damage, but I had had this process of writing this book, and I thought, how ironic would it be if after writing this, I suddenly had a child who fit these categories? And I'm just going to read to you the very ending of the book about that whole experience of what it was like having the possibility wafted in front of us. Children ensnared me the moment I connected fatherhood with loss, but I'm not sure I would have noticed that if I hadn't been immersed in this research. Encountering so much strange love, I fell into its bewitching patterns and saw how splendor can illuminate even the most abject vulnerabilities. I had witnessed and learned the terrifying joy of unbearable responsibility, recognized how it conquers everything else. Sometimes I had thought the heroic parents in this book were fools, enslaving themselves to a life's journey with their alien children, trying to breed identity out of misery. I was startled to learn that my research had built me a plank and that I was ready to join them on their ship. Thank you. Thank you. And here's the film. Here's the film, I hope.
The word transgender hadn't even been invented yet.
He has a mentor that helps him. Chris probably had one of the worst diagnoses ever. Self-injurious, swollen intestines, poisons in his system, mental retardation, severe autism. And I was pretty much told to put him in an institution.
When I was born, my mom refused to see me for 3 days. She was scared.
Before I transitioned, I just wasn't all there. I couldn't quite share my feelings. I couldn't quite be a full member of the family.
You sort of get what you get, and you go from there. And, you know, it's your choice. You want to make the best of it? You make the best of it. You want to make the worst of it? Throw yourself a pity party.
I said, after writing a book, which was about how people found meaning in difficulty, it's hard for the kids to accept themselves. It's hard for their families to accept them. It's hard for the larger society to accept the kids and their parents. All of it is a struggle. I wouldn't ever want to pretend that these aren't difficult lives. They're very difficult lives. They're full of pain and complexity.
We have joints and bones that are twisted and distorted. So our life is marred with a lot of surgeries. Myself, I've had 30.
And there was one guy that had a question. He said to me, "Why do you live?" And my heart.
Chris did not communicate, he didn't sit down, he didn't put on clothes, he wouldn't go outside. He ate the walls, he ate the table, he ate the rug.
I could feel the back of my neck, you know, popping and sizzling, like my head was just heating up.
We couldn't eat in the home, we couldn't have lights on, we couldn't have the TV on. If I coughed, he would run downstairs and punch me.
I actually felt that
felt I had to literally extricate the demon from inside my body.
When I started this book, I knew that I was going to be looking at a lot of desperate situations.
And I would do that by cutting and burning myself.
What I didn't know was how much joy I was going to find.
When I was born, Dad said, "He looks cute. He's just got a big head with an arms." In front of me, I still have that way.
When I heard that there was a name to what was going on.
I used what God gave me, you know, legs to ride, and gave me arms to play football with. He gave me a brain, and he gave me a heart, and I try to use both of those things to the fullest.
The thing I've learned most over the years is to be a parent first. I thought to myself, if he's happy, if he stops hurting himself, you know, if I could hug him, that would be the greatest gift in life.
It's kind of pretty sure that I'm going to have obstacles, but I would have had them anyway.
I know my dad was very, very proud of me, because I went on a journey that he never dreamed possible.
I don't think of myself as a schizophrenic. I am Susan.
There really isn't any definition of what's normal or not normal, or far from the tree or right under the tree.
I'm lucky to have had her in this particular period of time.
The love that parents have for their children, can see them through an enormous amount.
Very much. Thank you all. I'll take some questions if anyone has questions. Or I'll just sign books if no one has questions. Yes.
I think this is one of the most wonderful books I've ever read.
Thank you.
And it is so, so moving. But I wonder, the differences are so great. I'm not really comfortable with associating all these differences with each other in this sort of identity that you've done. I wonder if you have also some doubts about that.
I'm filled with self-doubt at every turn. But but essentially, I think what I was interested in was finding what the commonalities are. The reason that I wrote long chapters on each of these topics is because I didn't want to say it's really all the same. Deaf people have the same experiences, autistic people have the same experiences, prodigies. That's clearly not the case, and I really wanted to look at what makes one of those experiences distinct from the others. But I did want to say that a lot of people who have any of these individual conditions themselves or within their families have the idea that they live in a very small, isolated segment of society. There aren't that many people with schizophrenia. There aren't that many people who are deaf. There aren't that many people with Down syndrome. If you can identify this issue of dealing with some measure of difference as giving all of these people something in common, then suddenly instead of being isolated, they realize that most people are dealing with some part kind of difference with some member of their family someplace, and suddenly they're in a sort of large company. And so it really was to look at the idea that these differences that feel so isolating actually can bond one to a much larger community of people. But that's a sentence or a few sentences, and it doesn't reflect the complexity of that process, which is enormous. I also thought that much as we test flame-retardant pajamas in an inferno to make sure they won't catch fire when our child reaches across the stove, so these extreme cases point to something which is true of all parenting, which is that you have a child who's somewhat alien to you and whom you look at from time to time and think, what is this? Why are you doing that? Where did you come from? And you always have got that degree of bewilderment, and negotiating your way through it as a child grows up is really a cornerstone of having a healthy and positive relationship long term. So, yes.
I was curious about the opposite. I was curious if you interviewed any kids who thought their parents were out of step, who thought their parents were unusual.
That would be volume two. I mean, all kids actually seem to think their parents are out of step and unusual, but the focus of this book was really what happens when a family that perceives itself to be normal is ambushed by a child who's unusual in one of these ways. I mean, I saw some families in which there was a lot of tension. There was one family I interviewed, actually. I guess there's one who really does respond to that. They were, both parents were transgender, and they had a child who, so far as I could tell from the evidence they presented, was not transgender. And though I didn't interview the child, as the parents talked about how wonderful it was that he was growing up in a household that wasn't oppressive like the ones they'd grown up in, because he would be free to explore his gender any way that he wanted to, I thought, but he doesn't want to explore his gender. He seems very content in his gender. And I thought, it's the mistake of all parenthood that we try to give our children the things we wanted and didn't get and can't see what the things are that they want. And in looking at that situation, even though I was primarily interviewing the parents about their own families, I really saw how dangerous it can be when you have parents whose experience of difference does not allow them to universalize broadly, but rather just causes them to think everyone else must be dealing with the same thing I am. So, yes. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. So I opened it, as I said, with a description of being the gay child of straight parents and what some of those struggles were like when I was growing up near this library. And I also then wrote about the whole experience of having a family. I mean, I've said a few times, I didn't put it quite this way in the book, but when I was growing up, I remember my mother used to say, oh, there's no experience in life that's more beautiful and wonderful and glorious than having children. The love you have for your children is like nothing else in the world. And when I was little, it seemed like a huge compliment. My brother and I were the light of her life. It was great. Then when I got to be older and she would say that, I rather resisted it because I thought, but I might be gay and I might not be headed toward having children. And then when I came out and she continued to say it, I was furious and I said, that's not the direction I'm going in and that's not what I'm going to do when there are many kinds of valid lives. But I do feel that it was her saying that all the time that pushed me toward having children of my own. And while I think there are many people who don't have children and don't want them for whom isn't right, for me, it turned out that she was right from beginning to end. So, yes. Oh, well, thank you. Yes, there were many situations I thought of putting in, but books that are longer than this are difficult to market. There were the ones that were the last to go. I thought about dozens of categories. I thought about, I know, people with gigantism. I thought about people who were intersex. I had a lot of things that I looked at. I tried to choose topics that didn't have too much overlap because I thought the issues for gigantism are sort of like the ones for dwarfism. I mean, they're different, but there are similarities. But the ones that were the last to go were that I was going to do a chapter on families of people who commit suicide. I was going to do a chapter on families of children with terminal illness of one kind or another, especially because I had interviewed someone with cystic fibrosis and her family for a magazine assignment and been deeply moved. Laura Rothenberg, who probably also came to this library, grew up nearby. And then I was going to do a more cheerful chapter about families who set out to adopt disabled children, because there are many such families, and I was interested in the complexity of their motivations, that they were driven in some measure by incredible generosity and goodness, but also some of the families I encountered by a need to have people who were dependent forever and who would never abandon them, and I thought it's psychologically complex. And that chapter I dropped only because I felt it took the topic of the book too far, and it made it too hard to knit it all together. So, wow, lots of hands. I'll start in the back this time, but I will get front. Thank you. I, of course, didn't write the reviews, though I would have liked to. But I think that in a way, it's the thing that I said in the film. I think that everyone knows that having these children is difficult. And I felt it was important not to write a kind of mawkish, sentimental book in which I suggested that it wasn't difficult or it's so meaningful and it's just always a blessing and so on. I wanted to examine the anguish that's involved. But I think the thing that's surprising to people who sort of thought, oh my God, I could never deal with a child like that, is not finding someone else who also says that, but finding someone who says, as the robot said, I wouldn't exchange these experiences for anything in the world. So I think the reason reviewers have focused on that and the reason that I focused on it tonight is because I think it's the more surprising piece of the content. But, you know, it was odd. I feel like there were a few reviews that said, there's so much difficulty in this book and it's too depressing and too hard to read and I just couldn't make my way through all of those stories. They upset me too much. And there have been other reviews that have said, you know, he's glorifying all of these experiences and not acknowledging that for many people they're actually miserable, hard, and awful. So it's in the eye of the reader. Yes. And what I also thought, it was a split that came to me, and I didn't write about it at as much length because it's become even clearer to me, I think, since reading the book. There's love and there's acceptance. And I found that while there are certainly parents who are abusive and horrible, that most parents love their children. They may be angry at them, they may have resentment about them, but most parents actually do love their children. But loving your child and accepting your child are two different things. And sometimes, if you love your child enough, you get to acceptance, which is what I think happened with my own parents, for example, am I being gay? And sometimes it isn't actually sufficient because the non-acceptance is so entrenched. And I did want to look at that spectrum. Thank you. Yes, you had a question.
Things that they imposed or thought were the most important things to happen to their children, or I bet in hindsight or with grown children and now with grandchildren, you look at it and you say, wait a minute, you know, maybe I wasn't such a good person. Maybe it wasn't such a good thing for this person to have been raised that way, even though that was I was doing it through love, except I think that implication for the reader is incredible. And I like very much that you didn't spell because I think it's important for the reader to come to that kind of place, that this is a large moment in society, really, to look at how one parents a child.
Yes. Thank you very much for the compliments. And I would have to say that I think one of the things I learned in writing the book is that to theorize these things is one thing, and to execute them is another. So I feel like this book is all about total acceptance, and I would like George to learn decent table manners, and I think it will be useful to him as he grows up, and I find myself caught between that thing of wanting to be wholly accepting and wanting to understand. I mean, children who are only accepted end up going down a dark road. The British psychoanalyst Rosika Parker wrote about trying to steer between the Scylla of intrusiveness and the Charybdis of neglect, and so figuring out how to engage and how to engage to the right degree. I would have loved it if I finished this and I thought, oh, now I understand what it is that one needs to do and now I will be a perfect parent. But I think I finished it just thinking I will be imperfect like quite a lot of other people. So, yes. I looked at lots of families who didn't stay together, I mean, or where there was a step family that had come in later, or they aren't all, you know, tight nuclear families by any means. There are actually a lot of very confusing statistics on divorce among people dealing with these challenges, and they're kind of confusing and difficult to read, but there are studies that show that people with children with special needs are less likely to get divorced. There are studies that show that they are more likely to get divorced, and there are studies that show that they get divorced at about the same rate as everyone else. And what I came to think is that dealing with these situations forces the marriage to become a more extreme version of what it was, and that marriages that were essentially close marriages, often the two people in dealing with this gigantic challenge together draw closer and closer and closer, and the marriage really does become stronger. And marriages that were not so strong in the first place, when subjected to the strain that's involved in dealing with children like this, fall apart. So I can't do the statistics. I'm not a statistician. I've seen all of these conflicting things. I've seen a lot of broken families, broken spiritually, but also just, you know, divided and split up. And often there's one parent, more often the mother, who accepts the child, and there's another parent, more often the father, who wants to fix the child, and that tension occurs over and over and over again. But I can't make the universal statement that it destroys families. It changes families. There is no marriage that isn't changed by dealing with this. So, yes. It's actually a topic that I address at some length in the first chapter of the book. And what I looked at is the conundrums that are posed by a health system, the parents who bring wrongful life suits. The content of the suit is, as you've said, basically to say, we would have aborted this child if we'd known, or we wouldn't have conceived if we'd known, if the parents hadn't been given correct genetic information ahead of time. The actual purpose of the suit is to get payment to pay for caring for the child for an indefinite period of time. It's unfortunate that we have a system in which it is so difficult to get the funding that people need to take care of these very, in many cases, very demanding children who need an enormously high level of care, and that many parents who may or may not wish they had aborted have argued in these suits that they wish that in order to get funding, there should be a way of getting funding that doesn't involve that betrayal of the child and of one's own values. But, you know, there are also people who brought those cases because they're just angry. And there are people who stay angry at fate all the way through their children's lives. I mean, there's one woman I met who has two autistic children. And she said to me, I love my children. I do everything for them. And if I had known how they were going to be, I wouldn't have had children. And I think anyone who tells you otherwise is lying. And I thought, well, I don't know that anyone who tells me otherwise is lying, but it's clearly her reality, which is that she's very engaged with them and she wishes her life had gone a different way. You know, that reality is out there a lot altogether. You in the back. And
I have a 16-year-old cousin who has autism, and he has two older sisters who are in college. Aside from the fact that he is a 16-year-old boy who's got raging hormones, has no idea, he has very little idea how to express them, and there is a lot of strain between himself and his siblings, himself and his parents. Not to mention the fact that the siblings, you know, probably also feel the strain of the fact that they're probably going to have to one day be parents to him. Now, of all the cases that you have come across in the research of this book and otherwise, did you see any cases in which, like, there was any, like, sibling, not say rivalry, but sibling, you know, frustration?
Resentment.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that here again, I found that there were some siblings who said, well, most of them said both. I met a lot of siblings who said, having a sibling who had one of these severe conditions allowed me to understand what matters in life, made me a more sensitive and caring person, made me more empathetic. And also that a lot of them said, my parents paid all of their attention to my sibling. I felt neglected. I felt badly mistreated, and I'm very angry about it. And those two things could coexist. I think it's a tall order for, especially for young children, to understand somebody's difference and to understand all of what's needed in the face of somebody's difference. But a lot of them came to the point, there was a woman who had a brother with Down syndrome, and she said, on individual nights, I hated having this brother I had to take care of. On individual nights, I wanted to go out and do something else. She said, but the idea of a life in which he had never existed seems to me a lesser life than the one I've had. I think that's what one ideally is sort of striving toward, but that's a very mature response. Some people get there slowly and some people don't get there at all. So, okay, I'm going to take two more questions and then I'm done. There. I really think that it's important in education and in the sort of life that your child leads to have a foot in each camp. I think isolating your child with only other people who are also severely disabled for education or for anything else really tends to make the children marginal, and I also think that the quality of education that they receive tends to be low when you get them in a specialized classroom. That being said, I think that if you take a child who is different and put them in a class in which obviously all of the other kids are going to be talking about and doing things that that child is not capable of and are going to have a social life from which that child is excluded, that's a path to terrible loneliness. So I feel like it's important to have inclusion some of the time, and it's important to be in a context with other people who are dealing with similar situations some of the time, and the exact balance between those is going to vary enormously from child to child. Last question, and then I'll be signing, and I'm happy to answer more if you come up here.
What are you going to be working on next?
So while I was working on this book, in my copious spare time, I was in the process of doing a doctorate, and I just submitted my dissertation in September. I have yet to defend it, but the research that I did was that I had a cohort of 24 women, each of whom I interviewed once prior to the birth of her first child, once afterwards, and then every 6 months going forward, and the children are now 4 and a half. And it's really a study of how women become mothers, the idea that while obviously at some level one becomes a mother the day that one's first child is born, there's a constant process of coming to terms with one's identity as a mother and understanding what it really means to be a mother and how is it that people arrive at that. I started off thinking that early motherhood, early attachment was largely hormonal and that later attachment was largely psychosocial. And I ended up abandoning that idea and saying that both influences persist over long periods of time, but really trying to look at how these women were changed by having children and how those changes ended up surprising the people to whom they'd happened. So, well, thank you all very, very much indeed. You've been a splendid audience. Thank you.